Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis. I am here on Industry Night at the gorgeous Line Hotel in Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. And normally it's Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, but I'm beastless again, which I'm kind of okay with because I think I do the show better without him. But don't tell him I said that. And I'm very excited. Before I get into what we're doing today, I'm looking at some gorgeous cocktails that are being served to me at this moment because Todd Thresher, who is the spirited advisor here at the Line Hotel in Brothers and Sisters, comes in every week with a creative concoction. Hello, my darling. What did you do for me today?
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
So today I did... Hold on, I'm going to sit down.
Yeah, you can sit down. Sit down and join us.
I can be the beast today.
Okay, good.
He's not good at the job anymore.
No, exactly. I'm totally with you on that.
So today is, I don't know if you know, I'm opening a rum distillery.
Rumor has it that Todd Thresher is opening up a rum distillery on the wharf, hopefully in August.
September?
Okay, maybe September. I believe we said August last time, and I believe I said really, and he said yes, really, and I was like, September. Okay. Yep.
So on Saturday, we got up at the crack of dawn at 4:30 and took an 18-wheeler full of all our distilling equipment and put it inside. So I figured this would be a good way to start. So one of the rums I'm going to do when we start, I'm going to do four. I'm going to do white rum, gold rum, traditional spice rum, like Captain Morgan, Sailor Jerry. But then also I have this new style I'm going to do. It's called the Green Garden, the Green Spiced Rum.
Okay.
I just got label approval on Friday from the TTB. So I'm going to make it a rum.
TTB, for people who
Trade
don't know.
Trade and Tax Bureau. They
control that
control
stuff?
Booze.
Okay. Right?
So I'm going to make a rum like gin.
It's super botanical.
Super botanical.
So this is a rum?
So obviously I can't make the rum yet. So what I did, I just made tea bags out of a bunch of different herbs. I used lemon verbena, lemon balm, spearmint, lemongrass, green cardamom, and maybe one more. Lime peels. And I made an infusion, basically, with rum. So I'm going to, when we make the distillery, we're going to put it all that stuff in the botanical basket and make it, run it through like it would be gin. So I like drinking rum and tonics. Usually I would drink Mount Gay. But I figured since we're going to have Thrasher's rum, we should make our own rum that goes with tonic. And since I've been making my own tonic water for a while.
Forever, right?
Right. So
yeah, I think you were one of the first ones in the area to make your own tonic.
Yeah. So this is rum and tonic.
It's delicious.
It's going to be the green spice rum, and then I made homemade tonic water with lemon verbena and lemongrass.
It's so refreshing.
It's summertime.
It is. It's perfect.
Yeah. Rum revolution. Hashtag.
All right. Hashtag rum revolution. We're on it.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
for joining
fun,
us. Okay. Thank you so much, Todd. It's delicious. Can you order this here?
No. Yes, you're going to be able to order it in a week and a half. I'm making a bunch downstairs right now.
Okay. So eventually you'll be able to order it.
I'm just going to go on the menu. Probably right around August 1st.
Okay.
I have some going downstairs.
Okay, so you will be able to order it eventually, but now
eventually you'll have Thrasher's rum here too.
Of course. You better. I expect some Thrasher's rum on my bar, quite frankly. Thank you so much, Todd. As always, he's very important in helping us with our libations to kick off the show. But I haven't even gotten to introduce my guest. I've known Erica Meyer for a while now. She appeared on Foodie and the Beast, our other show that many of you may know. It's a Sunday staple. We've been covering the food and wine scene in D.C. and abroad, and domestically, internationally, for the last 10 years. We're actually having our 10-year anniversary this year. And Erica came on our show about a year and a half ago. She's the executive director of Compassion Over Killing, and this is a national animal protection nonprofit. It's here in D.C., and they help to expose cruelty cruelty to farmed animals, and they do promote vegan eating, which Eric and I have gone back and forth on because I'm a total carnivore, but I want to make my right choices when it comes to the products I buy. And I think what Compassion Over Killing is doing is really teaching people, first of all, educating people on what's going on in these big ag farms, first and foremost. But secondly, we all could use less meat in our daily diets. And given that today is Monday, it's Meatless Monday. And I believe I did not eat meat yet today. So yes, I'm sticking to it so far. So Erica, why don't you just give us a little background on you and how you wound up with Compassion Over Killing?
Yeah, thank you. I'm honored to be on this show. And congratulations on 10 years of Foodie and the Beast.
Thank you. We're very excited.
That's fantastic. Yes, so Compassion Over Killing, as you said, we're based here in the D.C. area. We were founded in 1995 as a high school club. It was all volunteer based. And
wait, a high school club?
Yes, a high school club.
Like high school students?
High school students. Got a little bit of funding from school. Started it as a club. It was a volunteer organization.
Okay.
And it just kept growing and growing from there and became an official nonprofit organization, hired our first employee. I started working there in 2005.
Okay.
And before that, I was volunteering since about 2000. And Compassion Over Killing is now a national organization. We have close to 30 staff around the country, and we focus exclusively, as you mentioned, on exposing the cruelty forced upon farm animals and empowering people to make kinder vegan choices.
Well, so I guess my question is, let's start with the mission statement of the organization, Compassion Over Killing. It sounds like you have two things going on here, because you want the animals on farms to be treated better because you know that that's not going away anytime soon, right? And then you have become vegan. So let's talk about angle one. Let's talk about what's going on these farms and who are the farms that you're going to.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's sort of a two-pronged mission, and the ultimate goal is to build a better and kinder world for everyone. And part of our mission is to expose what's happening on big agricultural facilities. Animal agribusiness is what we refer to it, or factory farms.
Right.
And the reason why this is so important is this is where the overwhelming majority of the meat, milk, and eggs in our country come from. And we are given very little information about how these animals are
intentionally
treated. Intentionally. And a lot of the times, if you just go to the store or even a restaurant, to eat and buy these foods, you might even face misleading marketing. You might see a cow on a green pasture with a red barn in the background, or chickens scratching in the grass or sitting on a nest. And this is so far removed from the reality that these farm animals are forced to endure. So most people will never visit a factory farm, in part because they don't know where they are. But even if they tried, the factory farmers are not going to let them in to see what's happening. So we find it to be our mission as an organization to bring those factory farms and the slaughterhouses to the public so that they can see what's happening and make a more informed choice in the marketplace.
Well, so, but I mean, that sounds crazy when you say it like that. You know, why wouldn't the farmers, if there was nothing going on that people shouldn't be seeing, why wouldn't they be allowing people to come in and see the process? And obviously the reason is because people would be
horrified,
right?
Shocked and horrified.
So what, without getting too descriptive, because there's only so much I can handle, without being too descriptive, what is going on at these farms? And why is what's happening there continuing? Like, who's in charge?
Yeah. Well, that's actually where I wanted to start, is to talk about the law.
Okay.
Because when you think about animal cruelty, and I used to be an animal control officer right here in Washington, D.C., and part of my job was to enforce the animal protection laws. And these laws are typically designed to protect dogs and cats. So you think of someone neglecting a backyard dog. Or
right, like we just met a dog in the lobby, right?
Who was adopted from the Humane Rescue Alliance. Yeah.
Right. A little input here. If you do come to the Line Hotel, they are completely dog friendly, which is so much fun because there's always lots of cute little dogs to pet. which works for me, so as a dog lover. But go ahead.
Yeah. So when we think about animal protection laws, a lot of the times we think about it in terms of protecting dogs and cats.
Or domesticated animals.
Yeah, companion animals in our home, or sometimes even wildlife. If someone's intentionally cruel to a wild animal, you might be able to use that law to protect them. But I think, you know, my original idea behind it, and I think this is true for a lot of people, is that these same laws must somehow protect farm animals, or there must be a federal law that protects these animals. And on a state level, the reality is that the overwhelming majority of states either exempt farm animals completely from these laws, or they exempt what they call common agricultural practices. And what that basically means is if enough factory farmers are engaging in a practice, they're not going to use this law, apply this law, this animal cruelty law, to stop that practice. But it doesn't mean that it's a cruelty-free practice. And just as a quick example, if you were to tail dock your puppies without going to the vet and they get proper anesthesia, if you just did that at home with a pair of scissors, you could get charged with animal cruelty.
And you should get charged with animal cruelty. I'm with you.
And that's actually one of the cases that I testified in when I was an animal control officer. But if you do that to a piglet, which happens every day on factory farms across the country, it's a common agricultural practice.
They snip their tails?
Those cruelty codes won't apply. Yes, they cut their tails, they trim their teeth, and they notch their ears. And male piglets are castrated, all without any pain relief at all. Mm-hmm. Without any training, veterinarians are not performing these procedures. And that happens to millions of piglets across the country.
And was the original thought behind this that, I mean, we can do this because we're just going to eat them anyway. So we don't, you know, we have to churn and burn, so to speak, because we need to get the product moving. You know, there's sort of this blinders on that they're not real. They don't have feeling. You know what I mean? Like that people can lie to themselves about what's going on with the animals, and therefore, you know, money trumps anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think these are profit-driven industries. I mean, we need to eat. So there's the idea that we need food. Whether mm-hmm. or not this is the right food is another question.
Sure.
But it's a profit-driven industry that has taken a farming model. When you think of Old McDonald's Farm, mm-hmm. I mean, that's based on what used to happen. Old McDonald's Farm, small family farms. And it churned it into a factory system where these animals are treated like very little more than meat, milk, and egg-producing machines. Mm-hmm. They're treated like widgets. They're not treated as the individual sentient beings who they are. And so in order to produce as much cheap meat as possible and cut costs everywhere, animals are paying the price. And in most cases, the workers, the low-paid labor force on these facilities.
I mean, I can't even imagine the emotional scars for the workers working in those environment.
Yeah, slaughterhouses have incredibly high turnover rates because it's such a horrific job. And the people who are taking those positions are usually desperate to get paid to feed their families. They're sure. desperate for some level of income.
Well, and I mean, I don't want to go on a tangent on a whole other, but I'm sure migrant workers are the ones in there primarily. They're certainly the ones working at these big ag farms. I mean, because it's cheap labor.
Right.
So that's a whole other, I mean, I don't know if you guys even address any of that, but that's a whole other issue.
It is a whole other issue. There are a lot more reports coming out about the ways in which these factory farm facilities are mistreating the workers.
Right. They like house them on property, mm-hmm. tend to a, you know, a trailer. I mean, I've read several reports about it, and it's pretty, right. it's pretty horrible. So, you right. know, if they're treating the people that way,
right?
I mean, can you imagine how they're treating the animals?
Right. And there's a recent report that just came out that in an average slaughterhouse, there are about 2 amputations a day.
2 amputations?
I'm sorry, a week. 2 amputations a week of workers who are working inside the slaughterhouses, and knives are just moving so quickly that some parts of the workers' bodies are being amputated.
Oh, my God. That's
2 amputations a week is what the report was saying.
Because people are not paying attention, or because they're just moving?
It's moving so fast, quickly. And right now, the government is trying to speed those lines up, or allowing slaughterhouses to speed those lines up.
Well, so let's back up a little bit, mm-hmm. because clearly there was a turning point in American culture where not everybody had to have meat at every meal, right? Meat was a luxury. chicken was a luxury. Any protein, animal protein, was a luxury. And then it seems like maybe after World War II, there was a turning point. I know there's like some story, I think Michael Pollan wrote about it, with fertilizer, because they were using it for bombs, and then they needed something else to do with the fertilizer, and that's how it became a part of big ag farming. I mean, that was his theory. But the question is when did Americans' diet change that we had to have meat at every meal? That it was no longer a luxury. It was a, of course, it's going to be a part of your meal.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting part about the federal government, and we didn't even get yet to the part about the federal government having no laws whatsoever regarding the animal welfare protections for farm animals while they're on the farm. So
no, we haven't even gotten into that.
Yeah, there are no federal laws protecting these animals on the farms. But what's interesting is World War One is when Meatless Mondays started.
Interesting.
And it started from the federal government.
Huh.
And it was introduced as a way to for Americans to cut back on their meat consumption in order to save resources for soldiers going off to war.
Okay.
And so Meatless Mondays.
But wasn't that not helping the farmers who had meat, or there wasn't enough to go around?
There
anyway?
Wasn't enough to go around.
Okay.
Right? So you're already talking about this idea that mm-hmm. we're not eating meat at every meal. And now the federal government is saying, hey, can you eat less meat?
Okay.
And find other sources of protein so that we can save the meat for the soldiers who need it on the front lines. But they're telling the rest of America, go meatless on Monday to save some resources.
That is fascinating. I did not know that.
Yeah. And I believe it was reintroduced during World War II.
Sure.
And then it just went by the wayside. And that's at the point where we're talking the factory model system, which is largely, if you look at the automobile industry and the factory mm-hmm. model for the automobile industry, it kind of mimics at the same time that the factory systems for animal agriculture started on the rise.
Okay.
And we're seeing a lot more fast-paced production. How can we cut corners and speed things up? And we're looking at industries like the chicken industry that is now bioengineering these animals in ways.
What does that mean? What
basically
does that mean?
Genetically manipulating them to grow so big, so quickly that they have more meat in less time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the animals who we're eating today look nothing
like real chickens.
Like, right.
Yeah.
And the birds who are raised for the meat are called broilers. And they're 2 months old when they're slaughtered.
Oh, wow.
They're just 2 months old when they're slaughtered, but yet they have reached full size. Their bodies,
because they're genetically
manipulated.
Altered.
Manipulated.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, so let's talk about what's going on these farms. And there's no oversight. We're not allowed to go visit, but clearly people have made it in there.
Right.
So what's happening? What's going on there?
Well, I think one of the most important things to think about is the buildings. First, most animals raised on factory farms today are inside a huge warehouse. You might even drive by one
and
have no idea, except you might smell it.
Mm-hmm.
So the stench would be the first thing that you might notice. Walking inside these facilities, it's not even describable. I've walked inside factory farms, and the noise and the smell and the feeling of fear and horror is just, it just envelops you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these animals are crammed inside cages, depending on the type of animal. They're crammed inside small pens. They are breathing in this stench 24 hours a day. And most factory workers they have masks on.
Sure.
To protect them from this, but these animals have no relief from the stench, the ammonia stench from the waste that's collecting. And, you know, in the egg industry, as an example, these birds are in cages. They're in about the size of a filing cabinet. There might be 5 to 6 birds. They barely have room to spread their wings. They can barely walk around. They live 1 to 2 years like this. And these cages, imagine like the length of a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And the cages, there are like maybe, you know, 6 or 7 rows of these cages, maybe more. And they're stacked 4 to 5 cages high. And the manure just drops in a big pit below. And mm-hmm. that's just where they spend their lives. It's typically dark, and it's the stench is overpowering, and they're just miserable. They're losing their feathers. Some
sure.
of them are dead in there. So some animals are walking on the corpses of other bodies, of other birds. And so the factory farming system is, as I said earlier, it is literally just a machine. It is just churning out meat, milk, and eggs at the cheapest cost possible. The whole goal of these systems is to maximize the machinery, to maximize the mechanizations, and to minimize the labor input.
Okay.
And in a lot of cases where there is a labor force, they're, as we talked about earlier, they're mistreated. They're victims of this system, just like the animals are. And factory farming systems, I mean, they exploit everything in their path, from, you know, the animals who are being cruelly treated, to the workers who have miserable conditions, to the rural communities. These communities are, they're
environmentally suffering.
Yeah, the manure pits for the pig farms and the waste from, I mean, where does this waste go? We have 9 billion farm animals just in the U.S., being raised every single year, and each one of those animals is producing waste.
Sure.
And that waste is just being dumped back onto the land or in the water. It's not treated first. Human waste is treated first and then put back into the environment. This is just raw sewage going back out there. That's why we're having outbreaks of E. coli,
sure,
and salmonella. It's just going back onto the land. So these communities are flies everywhere. They can't go outside because it smells so much. And it literally is destroying everything in their path.
So, okay, so we have the big ag farms that we've been talking about. So the next question is let's talk about these smaller farms, right? Like really in the last 20 years, there's been a regrowth of pasture-raised, I mean, well, let's back up a little bit. So, you know, like the word free range is now a marketing ploy, right? So in Maryland, when you drive like down towards the Eastern Shore, you go down to go to the beach, you know, there's these huge track houses, right? That I guess at one time housed chickens.
They probably still do.
They're all empty.
Oh, so some of them might be empty.
Okay. I mean, every single one we saw was empty. So I don't know if there were some laws changes. I don't know what happened in Maryland, but every single one we saw was desolate. I mean, there was just nothing there. But, you know, so they would say that they're free ranged, but they were just enclosed buildings, right? So, I mean, it's not better than being in the cages because they're all just crowded next to each other, right? But
yeah.
But what is the laws about that?
Yeah. So free range is, as you said, it's largely a marketing tool.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means federally, if it's even regulated, because it's not regulated on all packages.
Okay.
But if it's regulated, it typically means that these animals have to have access outside.
Okay.
That's it. It says they have to have access outside. So it could be a large shed that has a door. And it could lead out to a gravel lot. That's access outside. That would qualify as free range.
Okay.
So the quality of the access is not specified. So, for example, birds are animals who are typically preyed upon.
Mm-hmm.
So their natural instinct would be to hide in a tree or in brush or in cover somewhere. But if you give them access to an open space, they're going to feel vulnerable and not want to be there.
Okay.
So they want to be under cover somewhere. So free-range chicken, as an example, most of those birds in the sheds will probably never go outside. They might not know where the door is, or the outdoor access space might not be appealing to them at all because it brings more fear.
Sure. I mean, they're nervous animals, right? Chickens, in general, are nervous animals.
Sure, they can be, and living inside these facilities
doesn't help.
Right.
Okay, so let's go to the next level. You know, and we've had farmers on this show who really believe in, you know, pasture raising, and the cattle are out, or the pigs are out on the farm, and they're eating naturally and grass-fed, pasture-raised. Somebody told me years ago that if they are pasture-raised, they're treated well overall. Like that you can almost bet that if they are grass-fed and pasture-raised, that they get to go to pasture and they're out there and they're not corn-fed or whatever, and there's no antibiotics, that are certified humane, that they will be pretty well treated. I know you're a vegan, so that probably doesn't sit well with you, but is that any better?
And that, I think that's actually the question, is it better? It is better.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly better than living your life in a cage or in a massive warehouse,
right,
with the stench of waste around you. I think that the question is it cruelty-free?
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, they're getting slaughtered at the end of
the
day.
Getting,
but the question is, mm-hmm, I mean, for me, mm-hmm, This is such a strange story, but years ago when I first started in the food and wine world here in DC, there was an event about certified humane. This is about 15 years ago. I never heard of certified humane before. I think it was brand new at the time. And they did this huge presentation, and it was really big in Australia and New Zealand at the time. And they talked about, you know, these pasture-raised cows who, you know, were raised well and in the pasture and fed well and loved and cared. And when they were brought to the slaughterhouse, they played, like classical music. And it was a very stress-free, low-stress environment. And I remember the first time hearing it being like, I mean, what the fuck? Like, I was like, this, I don't get it. But the more I read and the more I learned, I was like, yeah, I do get it. I mean, I'm still a carnivore, but I don't want the animals that I'm eating to be treated poorly during their lifespan. So, I don't know. Is it bullshit? You tell me.
Yeah. I mean, this is such an important dialogue to have.
Right.
And I think that these are questions that every person has to sort of answer and explore on their own and mm-hmm. answer for themselves. I think that that description sounds more ideal than anything that we typically investigate.
Right.
At the same time, I would wonder, does this really happen for every pasture-raised animal? Because there are some pasture-raised companies that while the animals are living relatively decent lives compared to factory-farmed animals, they're still sent to the same slaughterhouses. So those slaughterhouses aren't with the classical
right.
music
there's no,
you're describing.
Right. Well, but it's the slaughterhouses are part of the problem because
absolutely.
One of the things these small farmers will tell you is, you know, the USDA, like all these, where those regulations are
yes.
is what screws them because
right.
they would prefer to do it on their own. And, you know, I don't know if you know Bev Eggleston. He's a pig farmer. I mean, he is as kooky as they come, but he loves his pigs. And, you know, he would prefer taking care of business on his own and doing it in a way that is obviously hygienic and clean, but in a way that doesn't stress out his pigs.
Right. Right. And that's what I'm saying. Even if they are coming from a smaller pasture-raised farm,
mm-hmm.
most of these animals are still being sent to the massive industrial slaughterhouses.
Right.
So that part of their lives is
still stressful.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a break because
okay.
we've already been a half hour in and we have, I'm not even on page two of all the information we have.
Time flies.
I know, time flies when we're talking serious, serious topics. This is Nikki Nellis of Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. I am beastless, which is pretty good at the moment. I hope he's not listening. But I am with Erica Meyer and we are talking about compassion over killing. And we come back, we're going to talk about integrating veganism into your life and how you can do it or how you can start doing it slowly. We'll figure it out together. I'll be back in just a sec.
The song you're listening to now is Bring a Little Love by Kido. That is K-I-E-D-O. And if you're tuned in now, you're listening to Full Service Radio.
Hey, everybody. It's Nikki Nellis with Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. Thank you for joining us. We are in the fabulous Lion Hotel. And what is really fabulous is this cocktail that Todd Thrasher made us earlier. If you joined us at the beginning of the show, you know that Todd is opening up his own distillery on the wharf, and he has created a botanical rum. You can really taste the lemon and the lemon balm and the verbena in it, and it's so refreshing and delicious. I do believe that rum and tonic is going to be the drink of next summer.
I'm definitely enjoying this.
Right? Thanks to Todd Thrasher. So in with me today is Erica Meyer. She's the executive director of Compassion Over Killing, an incredible organization that does animal protection for farmed animals, as well as promotes vegan eating. And we really spent the last half of the show talking about what's going on in these big ag farms. You had a different term for it. I keep calling it big ag, but you call it factory farming.
Factory farms, animal agribusiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we really, you know, discuss what's going on in them. And the only thing, I want to go back to it for just a heartbeat. The only thing we have not discussed about factory farming is what can the layperson do to say, yeah, that's not acceptable. How can we get involved to change the big ag culture? Because people know it's out there, and maybe there's gradations of people who care. A lot of people only care when they go to the grocery store about how much it costs, right? But like with farmers markets and these smaller farms and people trying to eat better and eat not just healthy for themselves personally, but also for their community, is there a way for people to engage that says that's not acceptable anymore?
Yes, absolutely. The first and most important step is our individual food choices. So by not purchasing, not financially supporting the factory farming system. So whether that's choosing vegan or vegetarian foods, or being more conscious about where the meat, milk, and eggs we purchase come from. And you mm-hmm. mentioned farmers markets as an example. So what I would say to someone who says, I'm going to still eat meat, milk, and eggs, but I don't want to buy those products that are from factory farms, is to recognize that about 99% of the foods out there are from factory farms.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking for that small
even
percent,
if you're shopping in Whole Foods,
absolutely.
Right?
So it depends on what you're comfortable supporting. So mm-hmm. so Whole Foods does sell meat, milk, and eggs from animals who are treated potentially less cruelly than on a standard factory farm, but these are still high-scale production facilities.
Sure, like if they're filling their markets.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you're looking for that small family farm, you could try your farmer's market. See if they'll even let you visit the farm. Or they might even have a photo album to show you what the farm looks like.
I have to be honest. Every farmer's market that I've ever been to, I've done work with Fresh Farm Markets here locally. They have a ton of markets and central farm markets. When you go to those farmer's markets, if you say to any, I have never had a farmer say, no, you can't come visit the farm. They're like, oh, we're open on Tuesdays and Thursdays, or come on a Sunday. They want people, I believe that those farmers want people to see their operation, not just to educate the public, but to also bring them in and say, see how the animals are treated, see how much we love them, see why we have made this successful business, or try to make it successful. It's hard for those farmers. And why our product is worth that much more money.
Right. It costs more because they are a smaller scale and they are cutting fewer corners.
I mean, honestly, the only reason why I wish my husband was here is because he's cheap as F, as everybody knows. And, you know, for him, when we go to a farmer's market and we buy eggs and they're $6 a dozen, he's like, geez, $6 a dozen. I'm like, yes, but you know what we're buying. Like, we've been doing the show for 10 years. You know that these are pasture-raised chickens. We know who the farmer is. We know what they're doing. We have to support them because they can't make the same kind of money. We can't buy $1.99 eggs. Do you know what I mean? Because those are not healthy eggs. They're not healthy chickens.
Yeah. And I would say if a farmer doesn't let you visit the farm, I would ask, what are they trying to hide?
Right, of course.
So that would be the first step is being more conscientious. We can vote with our wallets mm-hmm. where food comes from. And on top of that, you know, there are a lot of efforts, including some of the work that our organization is doing, to challenge and change some of the regulations on these farms, to ban some of the cruelest practices, like the tiny cages for egg-laying hens. Mm-hmm. You can become engaged in helping stop those practices in different states across the country. You can also educate your friends and family about what's really happening, because most people don't know, as we talked earlier in the show, most people don't know what's happening because the industry is specifically trying to prevent people from finding out. Mm-hmm. So when we have that information, we can make more informed choices. But we also have to recognize, if we're going to go to the farmer's market and buy the eggs from those smaller farms that you have visited and feel comfortable with, that probably means we have to overall eat less eggs, because these are not mass scale facilities. So recognizing that even if we are buying from these smaller farms that we're comfortable or more comfortable with, that we probably still need to reduce our consumption of animal products.
And so that leads us to living a vegan-ish, vegan for you, but vegan-ish lifestyle. And I think a lot of me personally, I mean, I am an animal lover and I believe in everything you're doing, but that's a struggle for me personally. When did you become a vegan, and how did you start your journey on that?
Yeah, I've been vegan for 25 years.
Wow. And you're like 12.
I just did the math. I was vegetarian for about 4 years before that. Mm-hmm. And so it started in high school for me. And I actually had thought about it. I grew up in a family where we ate a lot of meat, milk, and eggs. And my dad's family they moved over from Germany. And they had started a German meat packing company here in the U.S. They brought it from Germany to here.
Okay.
So in my dad's side of the family was meat.
Oh my God. Okay. So you're totally the black sheep of the family.
Right. So not only did we eat meat because most Americans grow up, but it was your business. But it was my dad's family business. So
right.
We ate a lot of meat. Mm-hmm. So I do remember thinking about this at a young age. And I think this is really common for children to think about animals. And there's a natural affinity towards animals. We love animals. We love being around animals. And then at some point, when we start to recognize that the food on our plate is an animal, you start to question, like, why
reconciling
am I
it
eating
is hard.
This animal, but this dog is not somebody I would eat? And so you kind of go through that process, and it didn't go very far for me. There's no choice. This is what I'm eating. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what age that was, but pretty young. And then in high school, I started becoming really engaged. I think activism was just something I was really always interested in. So environmental activism was very accessible to me, and that was something okay to do. Mm-hmm. And so I read more about becoming an environmental activist. And a lot of what I read started talking about the environmental impact of meat production and how it's polluting the environment. It's using a lot of resources. And to help the planet, we can become a vegetarian. And I had never heard this word before, vegetarian. And I was in high school and I thought, that's what I want to be, because I always thought it was weird we're eating animals, but now there's a word for it. Other people are doing it. Mm-hmm. It also helps the planet. So I told my parents I'm a vegetarian. And I think I was
and
a
your
freshman.
Dad was like, move out.
No, interestingly, my dad was very supportive. My mom had a challenge with it.
Right, because now she had to cook for you.
Right. No, now what is the family going to eat?
Right.
So, but I stuck with it. I felt really comfortable with that choice and friends in
high
school.
So when you became a vegetarian, what did you remove from your diet initially?
All meat, so I didn't eat any more hamburgers or hot dogs, no steak, kind of all chicken.
Okay, so all
fish, all yeah.
Oh, so you took all of it out.
But I still ate cheese and I still ate eggs.
Okay, so you kept dairy.
I kept dairy, kept eggs, and then in college, a few years later, somebody mentioned the word vegan. I'd never heard of this, and I thought, what is that? And she had talked to me a little bit about what factory farming really looks like. And I had seen some photos of an egg factory farm and a dairy factory farm and thought,
that's it.
I had no idea this was happening.
Sure.
I'm done. I'm vegan, whatever that means. I'm vegan now. Mm-hmm. And the college campus had some vegan options. It wasn't great. This was 1990 something.
Okay.
93. And so the options weren't amazing, mm-hmm. but I really felt that this was the right choice for me. So I started a vegetarian vegan club on campus, got involved with an animal rights group in the community just to learn more, to figure out what I want to do, because I felt I had been so misled about how animals are being treated. And I thought, I want to help learn more about this and help educate other people about what's going on. So in college, that's when I got really involved in animal activism. I thought, this is what I want to do, but what does that look like?
Right.
The only thought I had was, well, do I have to be a veterinarian? Like, what does this mean? And then I was introduced to PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And I visited their office. I went to school in Massachusetts, but I was visiting DC and went to their office to visit. And I thought, wow, people dedicate their careers to this. I had no idea this was a world open to me. And it was at that moment I decided, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. So I actually interned at PETA while in college, mm-hmm. and got a job right out of college, and was there for several years. And then,
was that during the time, because PETA, you know, their tactics could be very aggressive for a while. I mean, I don't feel like you hear about them nearly as much as you used to. You know, they were throwing paint on people.
Right.
And they were aggressive, like, right. Live our way or don't. Was that during that time?
A little bit, but I was also working in the research and investigations department, so that wasn't my world over there.
You weren't part of the guerrilla tactics.
I was more engaged in, you know, how to educate, how to reach out to communities, and working with investigators. And so I did that for a few years, mm-hmm. and then I decided I really was interested in humane law enforcement, mm-hmm. and left PETA to become an animal control officer in D.C.
And I did. What does that mean?
Yeah, I did that for several years. It means you're on the front lines responding to all the emergency calls that come into the city about stray animals, injured animals, somebody
using an animal. Is that just dogs and cats?
Or no, it's wildlife, like, in your house. You might have a squirrel.
A squirrel, a rat, like, whatever. Okay. Mm-hmm.
There's a snake in your house.
Oh, my God.
Or, you know, my boyfriend threw my kitten against the wall. I mean, everything. So police would call us out, fire departments.
Mm-hmm.
It was anything involving, any call involving an emergency service for an animal that, you know, we would get a call and I would be one of those people responding to. And it was really eye-opening. And I think the law enforcement side of it was really interesting to me because we were able to enforce the law to protect cats and dogs and some wildlife. And I was vegan at this time, and a lot of my coworkers were actually vegetarian or vegan. And we would sometimes pick up chickens or turkeys. In the past, pigs were picked up. And so we were picking up farm animals. And farm animals are not allowed in the city. Livestock, mm-hmm. as the definition is, and poultry are not allowed in the city limits. So we were able to rehome these animals. A lot of them are at Poplar Spring Animal Sanctuary in Poolsville, Maryland.
Okay.
And so it was interesting to me, though, to see the difference between what this agency was able to do very proactively and how we typically treat farm animals, mm-hmm. in other parts of the country.
Right.
And that was kind of what propelled me to want to work more on farm animal issues, because there are so many. They're raised in the greatest numbers in the U.S., and they have the fewest legal protections. So I wanted to switch my career from dogs and cats primarily to seeing what I could do to change the game for farm animals. And that's what led me to Compassion Over Killing.
So what are you doing to change the game? What's happening?
Yeah, the first most important aspect is education. Mm-hmm. Because if people don't know what's happening, they're not going to rise up and challenge it.
But how do you get that information out there? You know, I feel like in D.C., I feel like that D.C. is a very educated audience, right? I mean, you know, I think we have more farmers markets in a tiny region compared to, like, big states, you know?
And we have no factory farms in
and
D.C.
We have, well, obviously, no factory farms. And I don't know what Maryland or Virginia look like.
They have a lot of factory farms.
But I feel like it's an educated area. So the question is how do you reach the people who are... How do you get the people who are uneducated interested?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, because the more we are actually removed from farming systems, mm-hmm. the more I think we settle back to the idea of Old McDonald's farm.
Sure.
Because if we don't see what's really happening, we assume the best.
Sure.
Because we want to.
Right. There's a picture on the milk container of a farm. That looks good to me.
Yeah.
Right. That must be what it is.
I'm just going to go buy my Happy Meal. That must be happy.
Right.
So I think the education is still for the urban communities who are removed from these systems. It still is relevant, because even if we think, and this is true for a lot of products across the board, whether you care about the environment or whether mm-hmm. you care about human rights, worker rights, a lot of times it comes down to cost.
Right.
And so we might state one value because we actually do care about this issue. But when it comes to the store and buying a product, we tend to still want to save money, and you might choose the product that's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes against the values that we stated earlier. So how do we help people align their values with their purchasing decisions? And I think a lot of that comes to the reinforcement of education, to not only educate people what's happening, but then challenging what they see in the marketplace. So challenging the humane labels on products where people have a different idea of what humane means.
Right.
Or naturally raised. To them, naturally raised might mean something really amazing.
Yeah, but naturally raised is bullshit, right?
It's just not even a regulated term.
Is pasture raised a regulated term? Or no,
I'm not sure if pasture raised
the only one I know that's I assume it's regulated, is humane certified.
So that's a third,
because you have to go through
party.
Because you have to go through the process with the yes. humane certified people. It right. doesn't mean it's FDA
right. That's a third
regulated.
Party regulated term.
Right.
So the only people who can use that are people who are audited and buy into the humane certified system.
Sure.
That's a very small market.
Mm-hmm.
When most people are going shopping, they might see like organic.
Yeah, but organic is bullshit.
Organic is a federally regulated. There are a lot of different organic terms. It's been very watered down, but in most cases, it is federally regulated, and it can mean primarily the food given to the farm animals. But it doesn't necessarily mean anything about
it doesn't
the
mean
welfare
anything.
Of
right.
the animals.
Well, and the other issue is when it comes to organic. My understanding, not just when it becomes as it deals with animals, but just in our fruit and vegetables, is that so what. I would rather buy from a local farmer who isn't certified organic because he doesn't want to pay
right.
the licensing fees, right? To use those terminologies.
Right.
That's a personal.
Yeah.
That's a personal preference. And as I said, I'm clearly educated on the subject. The question is how do we educate? Like, I had a conversation with somebody who you would have thought was super educated on this. And she's like, I only buy organic. And I was like, because? And she's like, well, because there's no this and there's no that. I was like, you also know it's bullshit, right? Like, these people are paying to be able to say that. It's nothing more than a marketing term.
Right. And marketing is so important. And that's partly why we buy the foods that we buy, is mm-hmm. because they are marketed to us. And so one of the things that we do is challenge some of that marketing. And as an example, years ago, there used to be a claim almost ubiquitous on egg cartons across the country that said animal care certified. And what that meant was that that egg company had bought into a voluntary program by an egg industry trade group that mm-hmm. allowed them to use animal care certified. And in order to do that, you had to agree to certain standards of animal care.
But did anybody check on it?
The animal care standards basically codified industry norms.
Okay.
So it set a standard that basically said,
you're
already doing the right thing. Maybe take one bird out of every cage, you qualify, animal care certified. And what it meant to consumers with these animals led better lives than eggs from birds who didn't have an animal care certified stamp on mm-hmm. those packages. And it meant almost nothing to the birds. So we exposed this as a scam.
Okay.
And that product packaging was challenged. We brought it to the Better Business Bureau. The egg industry challenged it. Eventually, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, got involved. And you will no longer find animal care certified on any egg cartons across the country because it has been deemed misleading. So that's the type of work that we do also, is to challenge that marketing, so that misleading marketing is removed from packages, so the consumers aren't misled into thinking the products they're buying are more humane than they are in reality.
Okay, so those are some of the things that you guys are doing as a way. Now, I do
right.
want to talk a little bit about being a vegan,
yes.
because off-air...
I have some experience.
You do? You've been doing it for a long time. So off-air, we were talking about being a vegan now compared to you being a vegan in the early 90s mm-hmm. is like night and day, right?
Oh, tremendously.
I mean, even 15 years ago, you can go into some of the best restaurants in the world, and if you said, I'm a vegan, they would serve you a plate of steamed vegetables and be like, screw you. Like, you don't like it, don't like it. But they really did not accommodate vegetarians.
They didn't know what that meant, really.
But I don't think they really cared.
Right.
I mean, there were some chefs who were outright offended mm-hmm. by vegetarians. Forget vegans. But obviously, we're in a very different world today. I mean, first of all, restaurants cost a ton of money, and you have people with gluten-free, restrictive diets. Whether people are paleo or gluten-free or whatever it is, being a vegetarian or vegan are like simple compared to people with allergies and et cetera, peanut-free, all that kind of stuff. So I think we're finding now, I know in my, based on the pitches I get in the food world, that there are restaurants that dedicate a large portion of their menus, not entirely 100% vegan, but a lot of vegetarian options and a lot of options that can be made vegan, you know, like taking out the cheese, which is the hardest part for me, I have to be honest. Do you know what I mean? Like taking out the cheese or taking out the egg or whatever in order to accommodate people. Mm-hmm. So there's way more available, but there's also products available. And I am very conflicted about products. Like, for example, my son is a camp counselor at a Jewish camp, right? So it's dairy only. But he brings whatever it is, like tofurkey or I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So tofurkey. So that's what he brings.
Great.
Every day. You know, he brings that in a wrap or whatever. And that's his lunch. But I don't know what the hell it is. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what that product is. I know it's tofu when I eat tofu, but I don't know how they pressed it and made it into that product. So my question is when we're processing products to accommodate a vegan lifestyle, is that really healthy?
So
I know that's a loaded question, but you understand what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, no, this is a really big topic. And I would say that when choosing plant-based foods, vegan foods, to eat what you're comfortable eating. So yes, tofurkey is a processed product, but if you were to buy a meat-based deli slice, it's also a processed product, right? So in most cases, it's a processed
product. Most cases, not all cases.
Processed product. Right. So what tofurkey offers is an animal-free product that is also cholesterol-free because cholesterol only comes from animals. You don't eat cholesterol from plants.
Okay.
So it's a cholesterol-free product. And it mimics the flavors of a deli slice, let's say turkey,
mm-hmm.
of a turkey slice. So it is designed for someone who wants the familiarity of eating turkey, the sort of mouthfeel, the flavors, but doesn't want to eat an actual animal. That's not appealing to everyone. So if that's not appealing to you, don't eat it.
Right.
Instead, put cucumbers and tomatoes and other vegetables on your sandwich. So mm-hmm. it's all about what you want to eat, what you're comfortable eating. And you might try a tofurkey and say, this is not, I don't like this. But that doesn't mean there might be another deli slice, a vegan-based deli slice, or, you know, there are so many veggie burgers out there. You might try one you don't like.
Right, well,
it doesn't mean all veggie burgers are bad. It just means that's just not one that you like.
Well, and I think as we were talking about off air, I mean, I was just at an event about that new product. What do they call it? Just Scramble?
Yeah.
They're the people behind Just Mayo, which is an eggless mayo, which is actually pretty good. And they have this product that is egg-like, can be used in baking, and scrambles like an egg. Mm-hmm. And it's made from a strain of some mung bean, like some sort of mm-hmm. Legume, I guess. And it's really interesting, but as you and I were talking about, like, why call it an egg? I mean, it's not an egg. Or why do we need to recreate meat-based products? Can't we just can't there just be products for the vegan community that everybody can like without like having to recreating the wheel? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think our taste buds are all so different and unique that mm-hmm. some vegans really like to have their vegan sausage.
Right.
And their vegan ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And other vegans are really happy eating quinoa and
granitas.
Yeah.
Right.
So it just depends on your taste buds. And a lot of these products, like the Follow Your Heart also makes a vegan egg scramble. They're designed as transition products
mm-hmm.
to move away from the animal-based egg scramble or the animal-based sausage or whatever it is
mm-hmm.
and transition into a plant-based version of that food. So virtually anything that you eat that's animal-based, you can find a vegan version of. So it's considered sort of a transitionary process. And,
well,
it is generally a healthier diet, but you can be a very unhealthy vegan. I mean, Oreos are vegan.
Right, exactly. Wait, are Oreos vegan?
Yes.
What's Oreos in it? Isn't vegan. The cream lard? It's I thought the cream was lard.
I think years ago it used to be
lard.
Years ago.
Okay, well, I'm sticking with lard. I don't touch them.
You can think
them.
It's lard,
right.
But it is vegan.
Okay.
So you can be a very unhealthy vegan. So being vegan doesn't inherently mean you're healthier. It does mean you're eating a cholesterol-free diet because that only comes
from animal
from
fat.
Animals. But mm-hmm. it could still have saturated fats. Like coconut has saturated fats.
Mm-hmm.
But it generally means when people think of a vegan diet, they do generally think of healthier foods. Somebody who eats a lot more whole fruits, vegetables, grains.
Legumes, right.
Yeah. And that, you know, so so being vegan in and of itself can mean a whole range of things.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily mean that you're that fit athletic person who only
right.
eats bananas right. all day.
So we have to wrap up shortly, and I want to get into some of the upcoming things that Compassion Over Killing is doing. But one of the things I just want to touch upon quickly, I was hoping we were going to be able to spend more time on it, is, you know, the story is that eating a vegan lifestyle is not just healthy for yourself, but it's also healthier for the environment and healthy for everybody else. And that
for the animals, especially.
For the animals, especially, obviously. But you know, and that some of these vegan products actually have the ability to feed more people.
Right.
And they're doing it in a way that does not ruin the environment or hurt any animals.
Right. Right. So eating a vegan diet, eating plant-based, does protect the environment. It is considered by the United Nations a way to stop the harm caused, the pollution and other harms caused by animal agriculture. So livestock, raising animals for food, is considered one of the leading causes of pollution and resource depletion today. So switching to a plant-based diet is even advised by the United Nations. It is also better for our own health. So a lot of the diseases that are very common in this country, heart disease, diabetes, can actually be reversed with a plant-based diet. So when we're talking about our own health, people ask, like, where do you get your protein? Oftentimes for a vegetarian or vegan. And how many people do you know with a protein deficiency?
Like, protein's not a problem.
Right. The deficiency in our country today actually is fiber deficiency, and you get fiber from plants. So vegetarians and vegans eating a higher level of plants are getting more fiber. And that's what our diet is lacking in the United States today, is often fiber. So when we're talking about...
It doesn't mean go eat a bunch of those fiber bars, those junky...
No, it means
that's not real stuff. Don't eat that stuff.
It means eat your vegetables. It's sort of the mantra you grew up hearing. Eat your fruits
and vegetables. Exactly. All right. We have to wrap it up, Erica, but you guys have some big events coming up.
Yes.
Tell us about them quickly.
Well, the main one I want to talk about is the DC Veg Fest. Mm-hmm. So that's Saturday, September 15th. Mm-hmm. It's in Yards Park. We're just getting ready to announce some of our speakers this year. So you can go to the website, dcvegfest.com.
VEGFEST.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And it's a free event. People, about 20, 25,000 people show up every year. We've got dozens of food vendors, nonprofit vendors, commercial vendors, a main stage, cooking demos, a kids' activity zone, a beer garden. Every year so far, the past several years, the Humane Rescue Alliance has been there with animals up for adoption, live music. It's a fun day for everyone. And the main goal is to have a celebration where we want vegans to come out, but their job is to bring their pre-vegan friends and family to have a good time and
try
new foods.
Yes, I'm pre-vegan.
Yes.
I'm definitely pre-vegan.
You need to come out to the DC Veg Fest.
Without a doubt. I will not miss it. And then you also have Meat Out 2018.
Well, so that meet out is in March, March 20th. So that passed.
Oh, sorry, that passed.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. But these are all, a lot of the campaigns that we do are designed to bring vegan food to people to try it for the first time. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the challenge when people think about vegan eating, they think about eating tofu.
Right.
And it's so much more than that. So our job is to introduce people to delicious vegan food.
Excellent. All right, Erica, thank you so much for joining us today. Erica Meyer is the Executive Director of Compassion Over Killing. We had an amazing conversation today about factory farming, what it's doing to our environment and what it's doing to these poor animals, and also what you can do to participate and maybe alleviate some of this horror that's actually happening, and maybe becoming more vegan, not totally vegan for some of us, but more vegan in your life is a good idea, not just for health reasons, but for environmental ones as well. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Next week, believe it or not, we're sort of sticking on this farm concept. I have Lauren from DC Greens coming in. She's bringing in a whole panel. We're going to talk about how we get fresh fruits and vegetables in the hands of people who don't have access. It's going to be a great conversation. So this is Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. Once again, I was beastless, but I don't think that really ruined the show. Anyway, please have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.